time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Ari Cohn. Ari Cohn is founder, president, and managing director of the Post-Prison Education Program. Ari, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So start out and tell us, what is the Post-Prison Education Program?
It's a small Washington nonprofit that helps men and women leaving prison get into college or vocational training with the idea of keeping them from returning to prison. And we've been, over the last 6 years, we've been incredibly successful. We've had two people recidivate. Our percentage of recidivism is about 1.8, less than 2%, versus the DOC, or the Department of Corrections, 3-year recidivism rate of 28%, 5-year recidivism rate of 43%, or readmission rate of 43.2%. So.
And what was your motivation in founding this organization?
Yeah, in 2005, I was introduced by another nonprofit to a man who was coming out of prison. He was coming out as his brother was going in, and they had been doing that consistently since 1982. And I heard him speak, and I thought, and I was really just moved. I was moved by this guy's story. And, so I made arrangements to have breakfast with him. And, I picked him up at the Aloha, which is transitional home up on 99 for people transitioning from homelessness. And we spent a couple hours up on Capitol Hill at breakfast, and he was mentally ill, highly addicted, and highly intelligent, and just super wonderful guy. And I thought, I had just spent 4 years at the University of Washington, and I thought that if anything could help him put his life together, it would be post-secondary education. So I wrote an email to Mike McCann, who was head of Law Societies and Justice at the University of Washington at the time, and asked him if he would support a program that would help people like Kevin get into into college and not go back to prison. And McCann responded, yes, yes, yes. And then I talked to two other people, including Robin Hennis, who's one of the top people in admissions at UW, and got the same positive response. And August 2005, we sat down at the UW Faculty Club and decided to start the program.
And how do you, where do you get your funding from?
Initially, until my mother and I ran out of money, it was private from the two of us. Then we started getting money from foundations. Lucky Seven Foundation, which is a local foundation, has been really good to us. And our largest funder right now is Warren Buffett's sister's foundation, Doris Buffett's Sunshine Lady Foundation. And probably our second largest funder is a combination of Google Incorporated through the Tides Foundation and Google employees. And then there are quite a number of other foundations and a lot of private donations.
Right. So talk about the role that education plays in these people's lives. I mean, obviously, we all hear that, you know, if you want to go anywhere, get a decent job these days, you got to go to college and get a degree. Is that even more so for people coming out of prison?
Yeah, I think so, and for a lot of reasons. I get every once in a while now you hear that college costs so much, you hear people question whether it's worth it or not, and I actually get angry at that because I see it save lives every day. But with a former prisoner, it's even more important, and it's because you put them in a clean, safe, healthy environment where they might not have been before and might not be otherwise. So a college campus is a great place to be. And so that's one really important aspect of it. And then you offer them a future. You know, you offer them hope and opportunity. that they don't have otherwise, and that's really key. I know if you're in prison and maybe you've been there 4 or 5 or 10 times before, and you're coming out again, and you think there's no reason that things are going to be different this time than the last time, that there's no more opportunity offered to you in the future than in the past, then as soon as your feet hit the ground, you're going to react in a certain way. But if you believe there's hope and opportunity, and somebody's told you we'll get you into a college campus, and you've heard from other former prisoners that post-secondary education is real, and that they're doing it and it's working for them, then when your feet hit the ground the first day after you're released, you act completely differently, and it just changes lives. And not just for the former prisoner, but for their children and their families and the communities in which they live.
I've heard the statistic that it is it costs less to send a person to college than it does to incarcerate them. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, it's the first thing that comes to my mind is I think it's a mistake to look just at the cost of imprisonment. The last time I looked at that on the Department of Corrections website, it was, which, by the way, is doc.wa.gov, was about $31,055 a year. But that doesn't include the cost of prosecution. It doesn't include the cost of public defense. It doesn't include the cost of appeals. It doesn't include the cost of jails that people sit in while they're waiting to be prosecuted. And so those costs can go from a murder case can be $500,000. A death penalty case can be over $3 million. So the cost of imprisonment almost becomes irrelevant. But the cost of helping somebody build a life worth living, as we call it, is minimal. Our non-administrative cost per student per year is about $6,750 right now. And it's pretty neat to spend that small amount of money, which it's a big amount for a small nonprofit, but to spend that small amount of money and see somebody reunite with their family, reunite with their kids, build a future, turn their lives around, be clean and sober and happy, and a contributing member of society. It's pretty cool.
So does our state or does any state fund programs like yours?
Our state won't, and I don't know of any state that does. The feds, I understand the Gates Foundation is looking at doing it, but to my knowledge, nobody in the United States does it, and they should. I got an email from a former member of the governor's cabinet last year who told me it's a fair statement to say that legislative cowardice, fear of being attacked for being soft on crime during elections, is the reason that the state of Washington doesn't fund post-secondary education for prisoners or former prisoners. And I believe that, and I totally believe it, and I've seen examples of that a thousand times, and it's really sad and it's really pathetic and outrageous.
But looking at the success rate of your program alone, if that was mirrored in other states, it would seem to be just at the financial end for the state, it would seem to be a smart investment to invest in programs like yours with your low recidivism rate.
You know, when Eldon Vale was Secretary of the Department of Corrections, he called me one morning really early, and he said, data matters in this environment which we're in, which is like, that was 2 years ago, the beginning of all this financial crisis. And he said, you just have got to get data. And so we spent, coincidentally, about a week later, a foundation's lawyer walked in and offered us $25,000, and he said the same thing: you've got to report your success rates. And so they gave us $25,000, and we hired three UW researchers, and two Januaries ago on the 15th, David Lovell, who was the head researcher, and myself and one other reported to the Senate, Washington State Senate, that we had had nobody recidivate at that point, nobody. There was a 27-minute presentation to Jim Hargrove's Human Services Committee, and at the end, all Hargrove had to say was, looks promising. And I thought to myself, looks promising. You know, we're stopping people from returning to prison. We're delivering on the byline that's on the DOC's website, which talks about safer communities. And all you've got to do is say it looks promising. It doesn't look promising. It is promising. And the legislature has the data. They've had it for a couple of years. They're very familiar with it. And they just aren't going to move off of their fear of being attacked during elections for being soft on crime. And that's the overriding thing with it.
So maybe you can tell us about some of the individuals, the personal stories that you have been involved with, and tell us, what is the role that corporate media plays in this picture?
I mean, I think that the media, mainstream media, is the main culprit in this. I might be wrong, but I really believe that mainstream media is the single entity that's responsible for the public, the electorate, not understanding and not knowing the prison population for what it is. And you know, they print the sensational and what sells newspapers, and they put it on the front page, and they never print the background story. They never do that. So on our website, we just rebuilt the website, so it used to be the Why We Help section. Now I'm not sure what it is, but there's a video of a woman who was a middle-aged mom in Walla Walla, not even a parking ticket to her name, and married, three kids, and she was kidnapped and taken to Kennewick and locked in a house and repeatedly raped. And up until then, she was working as a nurse, which had been her dream, we now know, since age 12. And she was so traumatized by that she took a leave of absence from the hospital. And when Gary Locke wrote this legal declaration trying to help her get her license back after he left the governor's office and was working at Davis Wright Tremaine, there was a scene that you could almost visualize, even though it was words on paper, where Becky was sitting in a closet in the basement of her house, lights off, just cowered on the floor, completely dysfunctional, not able to function as an employee, a wife, a mother, or even just a regular human being. And in that environment, a woman who worked at the hospital came in and introduced Becky to meth. And she became addicted and subsequently lost her job, because you can't be effective as a nurse if you're addicted to meth. And then she didn't have the money to pay for the drug that she was addicted to, and so she started manufacturing, and she was sentenced to seven. She was arrested. She lost her home, her kids, and went to prison. And when she came out, she applied to the post-prison education program, and we accepted her. And, you know, when you look back at the reporting, none of the kidnap and the rape or the trauma and none of that hit the media. What hit the media was that this woman who dealt drugs was rightfully sentenced to prison. And that's all the public sees. And I see that time and time again. I mean, the worst instance of it that I've ever seen was when Jose Barbalito, the young Seattle Police Department officer, was killed by a woman named Mary Jane Rivas, and in August of 2006, and Claudia Rowe hit the front, you know, was reporting for the PI, and it was headline above the fold, section A, page one, for like forever, day after day after day. And the story that never came out was that Mary Jane Rivas went to prison as an addict. She was addicted. When she was in the Department of Corrections prison, she applied for and in essence begged for help with her addiction and was denied. She was refused entrance into the therapeutic community that was at the women's prison out at Medical Lake, which is now closed. And so she came out exactly the way society should have expected her to come out, an addict. And she acted accordingly, and somebody died. And she's now down at the Women's Correctional Center in Gig Harbor. So everything that was in the paper was what a horrible person she was and all the horror that happened. But not one thing about the state of Washington refusing to adequately fund treatment to help people overcome addiction. And not one word about the fact that she had tried to get into the therapeutic community and had been denied. So, I just think mainstream media is just horrible. Try to get Frank Blethyn to write an article, a success story about one of our students, and short of him doing it because he hears this interview or something, I don't think it'll ever happen. But, you know, we've got a girl, a lady, I don't know if I should tell the story, but we met her at the prison in Medical Lake a number of years ago, and I took a former prisoner in with us at the time, who was a big guy who had just finished 11 years, had 15 felony convictions, and I had Keith with me so that he could tell these women that post-secondary education is a reality, that he was doing it was working well, it wasn't some fantasy, that it could change lives, it was changing his life. And when we walked out of the prison, Keith said, "Did you see that lady in the front right row?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding me? There were 80 women. We were in the chapel there." And he said, "Well," he says, "I knew her from the streets." And again, Keith was is a really big guy, but he told me this little petite woman had pistol whipped a friend of his who was bigger than him to the ground. And Shelley was pretty wild. And she was highly involved in drugs in Pierce County. But that presentation that Keith and I did that day opened her eyes. And she, you know, for the next year before she released, she drove us crazy over the phone, collect calls from the prison. "I want to go to school. I want to go to school." Well, February of 2012, she graduates Bates Technical College just with about a 4.0 GPA. Well, she'll have her Associate of Arts and a welding degree. She's married. She's reunited with all of her three kids. She has a new baby, new husband, clean and sober for more than 2 years. There's no drawback to that. It's fantastic. You know, her family's come together. They're reunited. She's happy. She's clean and sober. Society's much better for all that having happened. And that's what post-secondary education does. And that's what the state of Washington won't fund.
And for families that have a member, especially a parent in prison, doesn't that create a vicious cycle?
It does. Soros Foundation gave a lady named Nell Bernstein a grant maybe 5-6 years ago to write a book, to do research and then write a book. And Nell wrote this incredible book called All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. And one of the statistics that's in the book that just drives me crazy is that kids whose parents have been locked up are 5 to 7 times more likely to go to prison than children whose parents have never been imprisoned. And, you know, I thought that book was so important. Mary Lou Dickerson is chair of the House of Representatives Human Services Committee that oversees the DOC from the House. And I gave every member of her committee in 2007 a copy of that book, and every member of Senator Hargrove's Human Services Committee in the Senate a copy of that book, and a lot of legislative staff a copy of that book. And it seems to have gone nowhere. But that's the statistic: 5 to 7 times more likely to go to prison if your parents have been locked up. Pretty sad.
And you also have people who have been in prison, gone through your program, working for your organization. Is that right?
Yeah, we do. I'm thinking of Dolphy Jordan. We've hired a number of people who, even while they are prisoners, actually. So, for example, a woman who was still down at Helen B. Radcliffe Work Release Center, she worked for us while she was still in prison through the Work Release Center. But 2 Februaries ago, on the 18th, a community corrections officer from Reynolds Work Release named Jason Mackey walked Dolphy Jordan into our office, and I looked up. It was kind of funny. I'm not used to seeing CCOs in our office, and we have a joke around the office. It's like we have a really close friend who works with Seattle Police Department, Kim Baguki, and when she comes into the office, I'm like, we don't allow cops in here. Get out, you know. So, but I was surprised to see Jason in the office, and he was standing with a guy I didn't know from Adam. And so I got up and walked over, and basically his message was, this guy has been locked up for 21 years. He went in at 16. He'd been locked up for 21 years against a 26-year sentence. And Jason was saying that he felt that that Dolphy couldn't succeed without our intervention. And they were just asking us to accept him into the program. And so, and we did. And at the time, again, a lady named Holly Christina was in charge of the part of our operation that works with students, and Dolphy was in the office every day studying. I mean, he would go to work or to school, and then he'd be in the office, and we got to know him really well. And Google gave us a grant through Tides Foundation. This time last year, actually. And one of the things we were supposed to do with the money was hire a volunteer coordinator. And Holly, and I just, you know, we looked at each other and just like, we're not even going to interview for this position. Dolphy's the guy. We're going to hire him. And today, if he doesn't have a 4.0 at South Seattle Community College, it's really, really close. He had 2 final exams yesterday morning. He's got a final at 10:30 Monday. He's reunited with his family. He's in a serious relationship with a wonderful person. Straight-A student. Gives back to the community, goes back into the prisons all the time, letting people know that education is a real opportunity. Amazing guy.
I also understand that the bulk of the people in the U.S. prison system, which is the largest on the planet, we incarcerate, 25% of people incarcerated on the planet, are 25% of them are here in the U.S.
You must be on my Facebook page.
Well, is that great event that you did a couple months ago?
Yeah.
So, and the bulk of those people who are in prison are in for relatively minor charges, just like, you know, drug charges.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the people that we see come from. Let me put it another way. White people with money don't go to prison. They hire fancy lawyers, and they don't go to prison. And they probably live in areas where the police don't even patrol. I mean, when I lived in Wedgwood, one day I looked out the living room window, and I saw an SPD cruiser go by 92nd, almost had a heart attack because I hadn't seen one in years. I was like, what in the world's going on? You know, people get hooked. Our students and the people that I've known who come out of prisons have been involved with drugs at an early age by their parents, to the point that I often think, you know, somebody should go dig somebody's parent up out of the ground, beat them to death, and put them back in the ground because of what they do to their kids. I mean, there's a guy in a relapse right now in Tacoma whose dad was a huge drug mover for Hell's Angels. And I know that from law enforcement, and I know that from friends of him. The dad's dead now. But he hooked this guy and his brother up in drugs at age 12. I mean, yesterday at our office, we had a woman in the office who's got 19 felony convictions. Her mother just died at a very early age of hepatitis at a hospital in Moscow, Idaho. And that woman had this student of ours involved in drugs at a super early age, 10, 12 years old, maybe even younger. So a lot of the people that are in prison are there because of drugs and addiction that a lot of times their parents hook them into. And then in one out of five instances, you add mental illness to that, and then you add poverty, and then you add no educational opportunities, and then add no parenting. So you were raised on the hilltop in Tacoma. We had one student, she never saw her father. Her father was just a non-factor in her life. And at age 13, there was gunfire in front of her house, and she went out, and her mother had been shot to death. And the police reports had this 13-year-old kid trying to resuscitate her dead mom and bring her back to life when she was already dead, and she had been gunned down in a drug mess. So, you know, you come out of that. Those are the people that are in our prisons. But there are exceptions. There are people who deserve to be in the prison, but they're few and far between as far as I'm concerned. I mean, they really are. I think addiction and lack of parenting and mental illness are huge, huge factors, and that this society has a moral and ethical obligation to address and is not addressing.
We're speaking with Ari Cohn. He is the founder, president, and managing director of the Post-Prison Education Program. Ari, how can people find out more about your program?
They can call 206-524-3333. The Department of Corrections said we had 5,600 phone calls on our toll-free line, and our staff can't keep up with the phone traffic, so they might go into voicemail, but my extension's 100. They can go to the website, which is www.postprisonedu.org, or they can just Google Post Prison Education Program and get the link. They can come by the office. We're in the Central Building at 810 3rd Avenue, Suite 180, and meet students and find out that prisoners and former prisoners are not what mainstream media has portrayed them to be.
And we've got the end of the year coming up. There are some of our listeners who are probably going to be donating to nonprofits looking for, you know, a tax break. Is your organization a nonprofit?
We're a 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit. Our tax number is 20-484-1958, and we need donations. On October 27th, our largest donor died unexpectedly at age 57. This was a woman who, along with her husband, was responsible for about 8% of the $1.25 million we spent for students in the last five years. You know, May 31st, DSHS called up and told us that they had just gotten hit with a legislative budget cut of about $800,000, and they took $59,810.05 from us. And so we need money, and the more money we get, the more people we can help. And money given to us saves lives, period. EOD, end of discussion, it saves lives. If you want to save a life, donate to the Post-Prison Education Program.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Again, we've just been talking with Ari Cohn, founder, president, and managing director of the Post-Prison Education Program. And you can find out more via their website, postprisonedu.org, or by giving them a call, 206-524-3333.